to the Last Horror Podcast. My name's Christopher Brown. England's most notorious ghost story isn't in a castle down in a, you know, in a an old estate or a country home that's seen thousands of years. Neither is it in a country pub or any of the myriad of places that traditionally would be classed as potentially haunted. The UK's best documented haunting happens elsewhere. And it doesn't happen 100 years ago. It happened, in fact, possibly, potentially, in your lifetime, for 18 months, in a place called Enfield, in London, in the north of London town. In August 1977, Peggy Hodgson calls the police to her rented home, her council home, in Enfield, after two of her four children claimed that furniture was moving and knocking sounds could be heard on the walls. The children included Margaret, who's 13, Janet, 11, Johnny, 10, and Bill, 7. A police constable said and repeated on tape on BBC television that she saw a chair slide on the floor and was convinced that nobody had touched it.
The local police could find no explanation for the knocking either. They were even more baffled when two of their beat constables reported seeing an armchair levitate across the Hodgson's living room.
It came off the floor, or maybe a half inch, I should say, and I saw it slide off to the right, about 3.5 to 4 feet, before it came to rest. I checked to see whether or not it could possibly have slid along the floor. I placed a marble on the floor to see whether or not the marble would go in the same direction as the chair did, and it didn't. It didn't roll at all. I checked for wires under the cushion of the chair, and I could find no explanation at all.
With this justification, and with definite strange goings on, the next door neighbour's family called the Daily Mirror when things were going strangely again that summer. Doug Bence was playing dominoes with the news editor when the phone call came in. The benefit of the Enfield Poltergeist is it's unlike a lot of hauntings, which are invariably in pubs down country lanes or somewhere else. This haunting was incredibly close to where people, incredibly accessible in the capital. So Doug jumps in his car with a photographer, and they soon end up in this house in Enfield. The Hodgson family claim that the furniture has been moved by their own accord, and there is evidence that the police has already been involved. They hear the story and think it's either a hoax or nonsense and decide to leave. But just as they're about to go and coming out the door, they're grabbed and sent and pulled back into the house with a shout that it's happening again. Inside the house, the children's Lego bricks are apparently flying around all over the place, going at a speed that couldn't even be seen. Recalling it in 2015, Doug said, "It was like when you were at a grandstand at Lord's Cricket Ground and you watch a fastball coming down. The kids were screaming and one of the bricks hit the photographer in the face." Graham Morris, who was the photographer name, took some pictures, but they were unable to capture any of this activity. The story, however, went on the front page of the Daily Mirror and immediately grabbed plenty of people's attention. With this amount of evidence, it's probably unsurprising that the Society for Psychical Research became involved. Maurice Gross and Guy Liam Playfair joined and became involved with the family and documented a lot of this evidence. Things moving, the children apparently levitating in their beds. The thing about the case is that it doesn't happen over a short period of time. There wasn't a day's worth of knocking. Guy and Maurice lived in their house on and off for 18 months, cataloguing paranormal activity. They lived in that late 70s home and studied the work of this supposed poltergeist between the summer of 1977 and later on in 1979, all of which was happening in this home in 284 Green Street. Now, the received wisdom behind all this was that Maurice was looking for understanding after the death of his daughter, and Guy was a writer who's known for writing great books about the paranormal and had become intrigued by the case. The received wisdom in a lot of this is that Maurice was attracted to the case to try and find greater understanding of the world after the death of his daughter. It's also kind of assumed that Guy got involved because of the sexiness of the case, in terms of that it was almost certainly one of the most high-profile hauntings, certainly in this country, ever. And he was willing to kind of get involved with the case to get a better understanding of it. And then write a book, which he did, called This House is Haunted. Which is kind of most people's understanding of the book is from this first-hand account of what happened. An eyewitness, you know, it's rare that eyewitnesses get to write the entire textbook on what happens and certainly have the, you know, the nous and the understanding of where it sits in kind of paranormal activity as such, or psychological world. And from there, it's obviously very clear, you know, the great passion and love both men have for this family to try and understand and document it. They repeatedly say, while these the initial events happen, levitation of the girls, objects moving around, that they are doing it because they feel that they couldn't leave these kids to their own devices. No one else was willing to help them, so they had to help. Almost all the activity initially emanated from Janet around her. Janet was 11 years old, intelligent, quite extroverted in a sense, quite noisy character. 11 years old, basically. And the events had happened after a messy divorce. Well, at that point, almost all divorces were messy, from their mother. Gross admits that a lot of the activity would happen, particularly around that Janet, when she was around. So it was obvious that from that point of view, that the focus, the psychological paranormal focus of this poltergeist was based on that girl. But offense did also target Peggy, the older sister, as well. Playfair and Gross maintain, well, Gross is no longer with us, but Playfair still maintains that this was a real activity from a haunting. They're completely pot committed in this sense. They are involved to the point that they couldn't turn around and say it wasn't. They'd been duped by a girl and had followed that account for years. It becomes more complicated as well. You see, Gross and Playfair were aware that the girls would act up on demand. They'd been caught out with pretty simple stuff, particularly Janet, bending spoons and playing up for the cameras. Now, to this day, Janet says that she's a kid and she's playing around. And because of the attention, there was a demand for them to perform. So they did. If there was a paranormal investigator around and nothing was happening, they'd be willing to do something to kind of fulfill the mystique, to service the desire that there would be a monster around. And Maurice was aware of this and allowed it to happen, or accepted that it was happening, because he believed that some of the other activity was so strong that it was obvious that it wasn't paranormal. You know, it wasn't the girls, it was paranormal. As things started to ebb and fade, a very chilling activity began. See, the Anfield Poltergeist started off as a poltergeist moving stuff, but then as time went on...
Maurice Gross is an electronics engineer and an investigator for the Society for Psychical Research.
Over here was Janet, and over here In this bed here was Margaret.
It was in the same bedroom a month later with all the family present that Morris Gross first challenged the poltergeist to talk.
And this was actually the result. You'll hear here the whistling first of all and then the barking.
And here is this noise.
The barking here is quite extraordinary, actually.
I then said to it, you can whistle.
I then, as I said on the tape here, I then said to it, if you can whistle and bark and groan, then you can talk. And I asked it to actually say my name.
Well, just a minute. I'll try again. I want you to call out my name, my complete name, Morris Gross. See if you can do that. Very good. Let me hear you say my name again. Come on, let me hear you say my name. Come on, my name's Morris. Let me hear you say it.
Now that was the first time we heard the voice, and since then we've been hearing it again and again, and it's been getting louder and louder.
It found its own voice. Bill Watkins supposedly died in the house before the family moved in. Watkins repeatedly joked and mocked the family and the investigators through his speech, which was emanating from the mouth of Janet while she seemingly wasn't moving her lips. Playfair, speaking about Janet, said she was all energy, big for her age, jumping up and rushing around to the slightest pretext, and talking so fast that I had some difficulty at first understanding her. She had an impish look, and I could understand why some visitors to the house in later months would suspect her of playing tricks. This was very much so, and grabbed upon this possession as being important. Janet could sit there for hours, speaking with this voice. And it became clear that to the investigators that it would be impossible for her to fake. They really believed it was not the work of ventriloquism, but the work of a demonic force. Now, it is incredibly easy to be suspicious of this. The poltergeist, this monster, would only act when it was not being watched. And therefore, when Janet started speaking, it became the first that time that they could have a focus on it. However, it directly put that focus on Janet. Grove says in the book, "It's smarter than we are. Look at its timing. The moment you go out the room, something happens. You stay in the room for hours and nothing moves. It knows what we're up to." And Janet when the camera was on it, apparently, very rarely anything would occur. That's from Maurice's book. And that's from Playfair's book. And of course, you know, there's suspicions, as these kids would be adding to the monstrous effects and the monstrous things that happen in the house by adding their own embellishments, shall we say. And indeed, Playfair and Maurice say that whistles, barking noises came from Janet's general direction, even before this particular element, the voices, started emanating from it. Playfair didn't think that Janet was good enough to be able to achieve this as a skill. And I think a lot of the thing about this was that the two men just didn't believe that the family had it in them to dupe them for so long. When the two men brought Ventriloquist into the room to kind of view this particular activity to kind of get a better understanding of what was happening, they would frequently become defensive of this world that they created when somebody else came in. So Ray Allen arrives and concludes that the girls were producing the voice because they obviously loved the attention. Playfair and Gross wouldn't be persuaded on this faking. In fact, their belief was even if the voices were true, a lot of the other activity they'd already seen was still unexplained. And this becomes a movable feast. When Janet gets caught faking, they merely divert attention to something else and say, well, yes, but this is real. Over 18 months, the pair become invested in this maelstrom of activity and become increasingly worried and concerned about what was happening with these kids and felt like they were the only people that could save them, could solve the problems. Now, when other people come into the room, that's a level that also happens. So Anita Gregory was investigating for the Society for Psychical Research. She suggested the case had been overrated, in a sense, saying that episodes of behaviour on the part of Janet and Peggy were revealing. She believed that the girls were non-psychically responsible for many of the events that attributed to this poltergeist phenomenon, although she thought that the actual outbreak itself, at the start, might have been originated paranormally. So she's her inclination was to say, well, some of this is obviously fake, but some of it was real. When the pair go to psychologists and experts and ask them for their opinion on how this can be solved, repeatedly doctors and psychologists recommend that Playfair and Gross remove themselves from the situation, that without the observance, the actual activity will no longer exist. But again, the pair just feel that they are unable to. There's an incredible piece in the book when Playfair effectively bemoans the fact that the world will not agree with their viewpoint, that the society or the establishments are unwilling to allow them to come up with, to provide help and advice and solutions for this problem. So the point that Playfair actually bemoans the fact that they're unable to get an exorcism on the NHS. This is a quote from Playfair in the book. He'd come off a trip from South America and written a book previously about poltergeist activity, which is where this line comes from as he speaks to an old contact. The problem is, I replied, that this is London and not Sao Paulo. We don't have centres like the one your family supports. Instead, we have the National Health Service, which doesn't want to know anything about poltergeists. Also, we need to look at the fact that on tape, the family, the kids say that the house isn't haunted. There's an interview on BBC Scotland. Janet kind of does the thing and says she hears some disembodied voices and all that kind of stuff. Janet replies, it's not haunted. And Margaret tells her to shut up. And then skeptics have noted the fact that the voice obviously originates from this child's mouth. The...
How does it feel to be haunted by a poltergeist?
It's not haunted.
Shut up.
Why isn't it haunted?
I don't know.
Does it frighten you, the things that happen here?
Well, it did first, but now I've got more used to it. And you learn to accept the things that happen.
It's Slanger covered it, Mum. My idiot, Mum. Slung a bookshelf at my
Have you tried telling it to go away?
Yes,
yeah,
many times.
No answer, nothing.
And what does it reply?
No, it won't. It's staying another 6-7 years.
Playfair states the fact that, you know, it happens almost without her mouth moving. And you can see it on the video. It appears very much like it definitely is coming from that kid's mouth. But, you know, whatever that means, whether it means that some kind of monster has taken over the child's vocal cords or whatever, or indeed whether it's something else, is really the thing in question. Some of the pictures that are used as evidence of these kids levitating can also be criticised. Skeptic Joe Nickel states that these pictures of these kids levitating, what it tends to do really is kind of show her possibly jumping up out of bed and with her hair rather than being pulled, and states that it kind of looks like Janet is levitating in midair, actually just shows her bouncing on the bed as if it was a trampoline. The kids were very unwilling to let Kit that anyone see them actually in the process of doing anything. Now, Ed Warren, famous American demonologist, supposedly was at the home briefly. It's not mentioned. I could find when I was scanning through the book in Playfair's book, "This House is Haunted," but he himself states it as being real, that he saw it with his own eyes, Janet levitate. Although he's also known for being kind of over-egging his stories to add more credulity to tales that possibly wouldn't normally have them. And indeed, Janet, speaking to the Daily Mail in last year, stated in a rare interview about the events that they had in fact faked some of the activity, about 2%, but no more. But how do things levitate and move without people spotting it? Well, Nickel says, time and again, in other poltergeist outbreaks, witnesses have reported an object leaping from its resting place, supposedly on its own, when it's likely that the perpetrator had secretly obtained the object some time earlier and waited for an opportunity to fling it from outside the room, thus supposedly proving he or she was innocent. Milburn Christopher, the magician who'd been brought in to look at the case, was very disappointed, in fact, and kind of made the assumption that the activity was around Janet rather than actually around a ghost, as it were. And of course, is the fact that regardless of the amount of activity, none of it's actually done in clinical or psychological trials. This proof, as such, is not scientific proof in any real sense, but eyewitness accounts of strange happenings. But there were strange happenings. Objects did move. The kids screamed. Voices emanated from a child's mouth, as if possessed by a monster. Bill was an unpleasant character who used to swear and shout and taunt at the people around him. That family was menaced by this monster. However, the worry is, of course, that it's a monster of their own creation. For me, the most interesting element of this, and reading the book, was that the Enfield Poltergeist is a sad case, regardless of what comes from it. From the Daily Mirror article to police officers saying they'd seen strange activity. The actual haunting itself, and all 18 months of it, and all the attention Playfair and Gross gave these kids and their mother, and this troubled home. Well, there's only two outcomes. One is that those kids, because they were kind of sad, they'd been through a lot, and were just happy for male attention, set up about creating and maintaining an 18-month absolutely horrendous hoax because they wanted them to stay. They provided on demand and on tap through a revolving door of supposed experts and writers and paranormal investigators and cranks and press and TV cameras what they wanted. They gave them and provided them exactly what they wanted, which was a haunting in a little council house in North London. Or there's another alternative that, hey, it's all real. These kids were possessed, were taunted and humiliated by a monster that lived in their home and wanted them out. Either way, it's sad. It's a terrible case. And Playfair and Gross, and in a cynic, will obviously turn around and kind of say, effectively, that maybe they extended it. That maybe, because when they started to lose interest, when they did start stepping away, the activity did kind of peter out and die. This normally, traditionally, in a film, the monster is removed through an exorcism or knowing its name or cursing it out. But in this case, it didn't. It just kind of petered off and died. So maybe some of this activity was real. Maybe it wasn't. For me, the takeaway from the book isn't really that demons are real or ghosts are happening or that house in that time was haunted. It's that regardless of the realities of any situation, regardless of the percentage of faked activity, whether it be 2 or 100, that family at that time really was screaming out for some kind of help that evidently wasn't forthcoming.
Shall we try and speak to him? No. We'll see if he'll speak to us.
Yeah.
Is anybody there?
No.
Who's there?
Doctor Who?
So it's not that surprising that over time, initially, obviously, with actual TV cameras and footage and the book and the news articles, but then afterwards, it's become kind of part of folklore in terms of cultural elements. So in 1992, the British TV reality show, mockumentary, as it were, Ghost Watch, was aired on Halloween. Written by Stephen Falk and directed by Leslie Manning, it was produced for Screen One, which is the BBC kind of drama fiction. It had been recorded weeks in advance, but was actually presented as live TV. Now, if you've not seen it, it's available on the BBC store, and I'd recommend it, particularly for this time of year. The film itself was incredibly successful and used elements from the Enfield haunting, including the fact that some of the activity was faked, that the cold belief in reality that from the investigator's point of view that this was actually happening, the two girl dynamic, the movement around the house of objects, and also the scepticism from other quarters. The story itself ends up being a reality TV show that goes wrong at a time when reality TV wasn't really like that. The story goes that basically, you know, has a reassurance about it. People like Sarah Green, who used to do kids' TV, Parkinson, who was a guy who was known for, like, you know, adding weight to things. So these are, like, you know, really, like, you know, TV type show stars, you know, more like a, you know, they were the character, they're known for like not acting as such, but kind of, you know, being on TV for like interviews and stuff like that. Anyway, the story as it goes on in the film is that things get more and more bleak. Major personalities die, become possessed, and the show itself almost summons up from the depths a terrible, powerful monster, and then the program finishes. In the same way that the Enfield Poltergeist had conjured up hysteria and attention, the TV program had done the same. The ghost had scared the characters with disembodied voices, sudden temperature changes, and spiritual possession. And although it was shown under the banner of being a TV program, and a fictionalized documentary, its documentary style fooled some viewers. The BBC became besieged with phone calls from angry and frightened viewers to see if the characters were okay. And the tabloids and newspapers criticised the BBC for disturbing people with their programme. Bear in mind that now that the programme is available, it's actually a 12 rather than anything more sinister than that. There were rumours that Sarah Green had advertised the programme on kids' TV, including visits to the location of the haunting, but that was actually debunked. They were very separate and weren't designed for, you know, the programme was shown after the watershed at 9 o'clock and wasn't designed for kids to watch at all. It was banned by the BBC afterwards, well, in a sense, was just not shown again. That wasn't uncommon for Screen 1 programmes, in fairness, until it was released on VHS and DVD by the British Film Institute in 2002. It's now available to buy online from the BBC. And the film itself becomes included as more mysteries. So powerful it was to shock and so frightening, it was alleged the film had led to a lad committing suicide. The BBC stated that in a ruling from it, that the BBC had a duty to do more than simply hint at the deception it was practicing on the audience. In Ghostwatch, there was a deliberate attempt to cultivate a sense of menace. They ruled that the programme was excessively distressing and graphic, referring to scratches on the children and the reference to mutilated animals, and it had aired too soon after the 9 p.m. watershed. They further stated that the presence of the programme of the presenters familiar from children's programmes took some parents off guard and decided that the kids could continue to watch it. The filmmakers effectively said that this was a drama in a drama slot, and therefore it was fine. I think they in their reading said that they were unaware of exactly how strong this was going to be and the events around it. But at the same time, they had to issue an apology basically for making something because it was so good. They also stated that in 1994, there was a report in the British Medical Journal about the effects of potential ghost-watched-induced post-traumatic stress disorder. However, what it came out with, the fact that, yes, the TV programme was scary for these kids, but they got over it.
It is, of course, Halloween, and if you were with us for our Ghost Watch earlier, may I reassure you that it was just a story, and all's well here at Television Centre. Halloween continues on BBC Two now, where the Marathon Vault of Horror is now showing Stephen King's Creepshow.
In 2007, Channel 4 actually put together a documentary which went into the details of the Enfield Poltergeist and spoke to the main players. It's 50 minutes and it's on YouTube and it's worth watching. Sky did a three-part drama in 2015 called The Enfield Haunting. Based very much on Playfair's book, it struggled with the lack of resolution in the story, but is a good enough representation of events in a dramatic sense. And now finally, in 2016, we have a different version of the story, The Conjuring 2, looking at the impact the Warrens had on the case. Now, the reality of that is the fact that the Warrens didn't have an impact on the case. Ed Warren had written in a book in 1980 that he'd seen this girl levitate. It becomes part of the pantheon and part of the story. But he's barely mentioned in Playfair's book. In fact, I couldn't find him in it when I was scanning through. And that in itself is a problem. Why does he reappear? Well, perhaps he doesn't appear because he wasn't really there for much of it. And the film itself kind of removes Playfair from the story, but keeps Gross in. And again, we get this story about the fact that the reason why Gross is there is to kind of get an understanding of and reach out to the afterlife and make better sense of the fact his daughter was dead. Playfair, but then, you know, and here as well, the Warrens kind of, they speak to Bill, and there's some reason there's some demonic nun running around. And, you know, it's a Conjuring film. It's exciting in its own way, but not necessarily that good in its own sense, in its own writing. It's like a lot of this kind of stuff. You wouldn't use the film to understand the real events or the real story, as it were, of what happened in that house in the late 70s. But it has got some fantastic 70s fashion in. And also, although, to be fair, the most unbelievable thing would be a 1930s council house would have a basement.
Do you know when the voice is going to speak?
Sometimes.
Does it ever say things just to you that you can only hear?
Yes.
Does it feel like it's coming from inside of you?
More like it's coming from behind me. Like I'm being used.
What does it say?
It said it wants to hurt you.
When did it say that?
Right now.
In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
So yeah, so happy Halloween. Hope you have a lovely weekend. If you listen to this on the weekend, we have got a new mixtape for you. It's filled with wonderful 1950s, 1940s Halloween rock and roll. So I hope you enjoy that. If you want to get hold of me, please do. The email address is thelasthorrorpodcast@gmail.com. The Twitter is @orange_monkey. Or if you want to subscribe to receive the mixtape, go to the website, click on mixtapes, fill in your email address, and I will email it to you. Next week, we discuss a book. This week we were kind of discussing a book, but this next week we're also discussing a book, House of Psychotic Women, which kind of goes into a very specific trope, which is in a lot more horror than you think it is. The idea of the mad woman, as it were. A reason for that is that I watched Lights Out over the summer, and I'd like to speak about that, The Babadook, and also the book in general, because I read it over the summer and it is a fantastic book, and I really recommend it. So, until next week, take care, and I'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.